Hi, this is Bob Scully, and welcome to another edition of The World Show, the Energy Series, a new production devoted to energy issues in both Canada and the United States. To launch this series, a distinguished guest, the Honorable Joe Oliver, Minister of Natural Resources for Canada. And when you say Canada, energy, and natural resources all in the same sentence, if you follow the news, you know we'll be talking about Keystone XL, a new pipeline proposal, which is supposed to bring more Canadian oil into the American market. And the supporters say, well, that's good, because it's oil coming from a democracy. It's ethical oil, and it lessens America's dependency on the oil. It comes from dictatorial states that wish America harm. The opponents say, it doesn't matter. It's a pipeline. Pipelines are bad, period. You be the judge. Here is the Honorable Joe Oliver. Minister Oliver, the world of energy is endlessly fascinating, as we're about to discover.
Yes.
But there's one big question looming that, when if we talk about Canada and the U.S., that cannot and should not be avoided. It's the Keystone Pipeline. What is the Keystone Pipeline?
Well, the Keystone Pipeline, which is the focus of so much attention in both our both Canada and the United States, is a pipeline that would go from northern Alberta, from the oil sands there, through Canada and south, through the American Midwest, down to the U.S. Gulf Coast, mm-hmm. where it would hook up with refineries and be used there, because the refineries there are looking for heavy oil, and be used primarily in southern United States.
And pipelines are a customary way to transport oil. Why is this one causing such a fuss?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a kind of an interesting question. I think that the environmental movement has used this as a symbolic type of project to advance their objective, which is to stop the production of oil sands, ultimately the production of hydrocarbons, as part of their agenda, and in fact their agenda may extend beyond the issue of hydrocarbons to basically every form of natural resource project, and it's not an exaggeration to say every one of them, certainly in Canada, has been opposed by one group or another. So, you know, they've picked, in my opinion, perhaps the wrong symbolic project to oppose, because the facts that I guess they're trying to alarm people with mm-hmm. really aren't there.
And is there no credence given to ethical oil? This is a debate that's been going on, certainly on this side of the border in Canada, for a number of years. Our oil, I mean, it's not because we're better than others, but we're a democracy. And America gets a lot of its oil from countries that are not and that have indeed tried to harm America. That sounds like a pretty powerful argument. Is that part of the debate?
Well, it is, actually, and it falls in one sense under the rubric of national security, because Canada is a friend, an ally, with a robust legal system. We honor our contracts, and if there's an agreement to send oil down to the United States, we will, of course, honor that obligation. In contrast, the oil which would be displaced from Venezuela, mm-hmm. Is far less reliable, is less environmentally friendly, and comes from a country that has been, you know, fairly hostile to America and its values. In fact, in the last 5 years, the Venezuelan government has threatened 5 times to stop the flow of oil to the United States. So, I mean, this isn't a friendly country. It's not a reliable source of energy. And that's one of the issues that, you know, we've been talking about.
And when I first noticed, when the project came on to the radar of public opinion and public debate, I thought initially, and I think a lot of people thought this, the issue was the aquifer in Nebraska, the Ogallala aquifer, and some very fragile terrain. And then the route was changed, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, it was.
And one kind of thought the problems would sort of evaporate. Why didn't they?
Well, because the Ogallala aquifer wasn't the real issue. But it did get the governor on side. And now, in fact, what we have is the governor of every state through which the pipeline will go is in favor. as, by the way, is a majority of the Senate and the House of Representatives, and the American population supports the Keystone XL pipeline 3-1. So there's a fair degree of consensus on this. However, there is a vocal minority that are quite opposed. Now, the reason they're opposed, as I said, relates to environmental issues. But you know, there's some important facts on the ground that have to be raised and really deal with those issues. First of all, the oil sands represent 1/1000th of global emissions. So, you know, we ought to be concentrating if we believe in the issue of climate change, as I do and as our government certainly does. We should be looking at the other 99.9%. One of the messages that we're conveying when we go down to the United States, and I was recently in Washington and New York, and I've been to Chicago and Houston in the last month, is talking about how our environmental objectives and standards are aligned with the United States. I mean, the first point is we have the overarching objective of reducing our greenhouse gas emissions by 17% from 2005 levels by 2020. That's identical to the U.S. standard. We have we're moving in lockstep in respect to the fuel standards for automobiles, trucks, and cars, and in respect to coal, which is a far bigger emitter of greenhouse gases. We're ahead of the world. We've got the stringent rules. There will be no more traditional coal-fired plants built, and we're phasing out the ones that currently exist. I mean, it's interesting to note that the emissions from the oil sands in total, not just though part of it coming from that would go down the Keystone pipeline, are 1/40th of the emissions from coal-fired electricity in the United States. Half of that from the state of Illinois alone. So, you know, if the focus, if the concern is on greenhouse gas emissions, well, there are bigger fish to fry.
Well, some sources have told me one of the reasons this thing took off and had such legs is that it's easier for the environmentalists down there to attack Canadian oil than American coal. It's just too big an industry, it's just too powerful, and it cannot be budged. Is that a fair assessment?
I think that is definitely part of it, because they would be taking on too many interests. I mean, right now, they're taking on the American labor movement, or at least that part of it which is related to construction. So there, when I was in Washington, there was a big demonstration from the labor, the construction workers who want this project approved as quickly as possible, because their focus obviously is on jobs. And there will be some 40,000 jobs created from this shovel-ready project, which, I should say, has been more analyzed by regulatory organizations than perhaps any other pipeline in the history of the world.
And have you done the Lyndon Johnson thing when you're naming all these people who seem to be for it? Lyndon Johnson used to say, "Do I really have the votes?" And he would check off names. Of course, it was simpler. It was just the Senate. Mm-hmm. But have you done that kind of thing? And are you fairly sure you have the support you need?
Well, we have the support, but of course, the Congress isn't making the initial decision unless they decide to introduce legislation. And I don't want to get into that. That's very much a process that that the two houses of Congress are looking at. But I have spoken to senators on both sides of this issue, Republicans and Democrats and congressmen as well. And you know, it's pretty clear that the national security issue is a very big one, for Americans, as is jobs. And those are two big, powerful forces, arguing for this. I mean, the other issue, of course, is, you know, what would the result of a refusal be? And, we would simply intensify our effort to export our oil to Tidewater and to
the oil
other
won't
markets
go back
around
into the ground.
No. Well, look, we're confronting a very broad issue, and I can talk about that, about a strategic issue about where our resources go. But this specific project is part of addressing the need to find a buyer for a huge asset that Canada has been blessed with. We have to develop it in an environmentally and socially responsible way, but to derive the benefits for our citizens, we've got to get on with the job. And the critical way to do that is building the infrastructure to get it to the markets.
Well, there are alternate routes, of course. We can go to the Pacific and can go. It can even go now over the North Pole.
And east as well. You see, here's the issue for Canada. We have one customer. The proof is in the numbers. 100% of our gas exports and 99% of our oil exports go to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
The result of that and a pipeline lack of capacity in the U.S. Midwest means that when the oil arrives at Cushing, Oklahoma, it trades at a significant discount to international prices. In fact, it's costing our country, our economy, some $20 billion every year. Now, that number, varies on a day-to-day basis, but this is a very significant loss for the Canadian economy. That's the short-term, very short-term problem, the immediate problem. In the intermediate term, what we're confronting is a certain a lack of pipeline capacity if we don't start building them. And that's going to become increasingly acute this decade. In the somewhat longer term, what we're dealing with is the fact that the U.S. has found vast amounts of shale gas and tight oil.
And everybody's stunned by that. 5 years ago, wasn't there.
It wasn't there, and well, it was there, but could they have taken it out, and nobody knew for sure. So we clearly have to find new markets for our resources, and we have to get our resources to Tidewater to get it to those markets and to achieve international prices. The demand for energy, according to the International Energy Agency, is going to grow some 35%. By 2035, and hydrocarbons are going to represent over two-thirds of the energy supplied to the world at that point. So the demand is going to increase. And then when you look at where it's going to come from, the projections are that 92% of the economic growth in the world will come from non-OECD countries during that period. And, we're talking basically about the Asia-Pacific region, not the countries that we have traditionally been exporting to. So we've got to get on with building the infrastructure to get the resources to the markets that want them. There's tremendous complementarity. Canada needs to diversify its markets, and these countries in the Asia-Pacific area strategically need to diversify their sources of supply.
And isn't there another reason for, I don't want to offend the environmental movement, but they better start thinking about coal. Coal is also the enemy in China. And the change with shale gas and shale oil, the change in the supply equation is such that oil is really not going away, nor is it going to rise to stratospheric prices. Nobody thinks so. A few years ago, it was $200 a barrel of oil. Nobody's saying that anymore. Oil is really here to stay.
Yeah, oil is here to stay. The discussion of peak oil is a quaint, ancient idea.
Yeah.
We're not going to run out of resources. What has happened globally is that energy is become more diffuse and diverse. It's coming in different forms, and it's found in a larger number of countries. So that has geopolitical implications. It will diminish the power of the OPEC cartel. It's very good news for North America because a lot of those non-conventional resources are found in Canada and the United States. The result of which is that our two countries will be energy self-sufficient in 20 years or so. It's a political question whether we become energy independent. But the United States will continue to need oil from outside the country. By 2020, they're going to still need about 5.5 million barrels a day, and by 2035, they'll need about 3.4 million barrels a day, according to the International Energy Agency. So, if they want the oil to come from their friend and neighbor, their neighbor to the north, a reliable, friendly, and environmentally responsible source, they can get it from us, and North America will be energy independent. A vision that a number of U.S. presidents have had years ago. It was a wish.
It was a very patriotic American thing.
Sure.
Theodore Roosevelt talked like that.
And then, of course, during the embargo, it became an absolutely huge issue. So it's now attainable through good fortune and American ingenuity and technology. So let's see how that works. And Keystone is part of that. It's part of a broad energy relationship that our two countries have had for a very long time.
And from where you're sitting, because you're in charge of natural resources as a whole, not just oil and gas, are you feeling Canada's a major producer of practically everything, and we're blessed, as you say, that's the term you used. Are you seeing a decrease in our output because China and India are slowing down, or is that an urban legend?
Well, yeah, they are slowing down a bit, but from high levels to lower levels that we could only dream of achieving. The demand is there, and you know there will be cyclicality, of course. But I mean, some of the numbers that we're looking at for China are just quite amazing. And then, of course, there's India, mm-hmm. And it's not only oil; it's gas as well, liquefied natural gas, which is a huge new market in British Columbia that's opening up. So, you know, we see continued opportunity to sell our resources, but there are some timing issues because the countries that have this long-term strategic need for energy will be wanting to, imperative, to sign long-term contracts.
Mm-hmm. Expect us to honor them.
Yeah, of course. So they view Canada in a very positive light. We're a stable, democratic country. We honor our contractual commitments. Once we permit investment in the country, based on the net benefit test. You know, we don't discriminate against foreign investment. And as a supplier of resources, we're clearly part of a strategic thrust to diversify sources of supply.
And on the domestic front, the other obstacles that may exist, in the U.S., there's interstate commerce that is often a problem. So is interprovincial commerce up here. Native bands and their rights and their historical mm-hmm. treaties and so on, the environmental movement, all of that. Are you sensing that that's becoming a tougher road to hoe or smoother?
It's not smoother. It's very complex, and there's a lot of really important issues. You mentioned Aboriginal peoples. We have a moral and constitutional obligation to consult and potentially to accommodate. We take that very seriously, and we've taken a number of steps in that regard. The Prime Minister called a Crown First Nations meeting where the Grand Chief and National Chief and all the many of the other chiefs attended. I've had numerous meetings with Aboriginal chiefs. Of course, the main responsibility lies with my colleague Bernard Valcourt, who is the Minister of Aboriginal Affairs. But we're all involved in that that type of discussion. We want to develop the resources in a way which will maximize the benefit for Aboriginal peoples, and I see this as an enormous opportunity because they're located near the projects, and it can really be transformative in a very positive way in terms of jobs, participation in the projects, and I just see this as an enormous opportunity. We're looking in Canada at about 600 projects planned or in the works over the next 10 years, requiring $650 billion of capital. That's a lot of money for our country in that period
that
of time.
That includes mines?
That's the whole resource area. And, you know, this is an unprecedented opportunity for investors. It's also a planned a program which is perhaps unprecedented anywhere. So, you know, we have to remain attractive to investors, and we've got to have the social license to proceed with these investors these investments, which means that the Canadian public has to be on side.
And in your department, the civil servants, there must be some fear that a lot of this, the accumulation of obstacles, regulatory and provincial regulatory versus federal or two different provinces, the Aboriginal question, the environmental groups, that all of that sometimes might be strong enough to paralyze a project. There must be, you must think of that, and they must try to work around that, but...
Well, we certainly don't want to see that happen, because the consequences would be dire for the economy and for our prosperity and security. See, if we go ahead, looking at it positively, if we go ahead with all the major resource projects that are planned and the works are likely to arrive, we're looking at well over $3 trillion in economic activity over the next 25 years, a million jobs, and hundreds of billions of dollars to governments to support critical social programs that Canadians have come to rely on, programs like healthcare, education, housing, infrastructure around the country. So this is really important for the future of Canada. And we're in a position not only to develop projects which will be good for our country, but we can be a supplier of energy to an energy hungry world,
and an including energy hungry neighbor.
Yeah, and including that first, and is our neighbor whom we have been supplying energy right now more than other countries. I don't know whether Canadians know that, but in terms of oil, we are the biggest supplier right now. It's up to 3 million barrels a day of oil and petroleum products. It's more than I think the next two countries in the world, and the gap is a big one. So of that, 1 million is coming from the oil sands.
Would it be fair to say, if this works, it'll be a great, certainly on the Canadian side, it will foster great friendship and gratitude? If it doesn't, be a bitter disappointment. I mean, it's come to that.
It would be a disappointment if that happened, and it would be a reversal of a long-term energy relationship. I mean, I don't think that most Canadians or Americans realize the vast web of pipelines that currently exist in this country. I think it's in the last 7 years, or maybe it's 10 years. There's 180,000 miles of pipe built. You get 3/4 of the way to the moon.
Yeah.
In terms of oil pipelines, 1,400 miles are built on average every year. The unapproved portion of Keystone is 875 miles. And it's supposed to be safer.
I mean, put it that way, it ain't much.
Well, anyway, and not only that, we have, I believe, 81 international pipelines going between our two countries. This would be the 82nd. So it's not as if the world is changing here. This is a continuation of what has been going on. And of course, it's not only oil, and gas. It's also electricity, and they're integrated grids. I mean, we are supplying each other with a lot of energy. It's going back and forth. We've got an interconnected web here, which is why there's so much to talk about with the administration and my new colleagues in the U.S. administration about the things we can work at together in the interests of both our countries. I mean, energy efficiency, attacking the environmental issues for non-conventional energy, international initiatives, and so on.
Well, Minister Oliver, from your lips to God's ear.
That would be great.
Good luck with that. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The Honorable Joe Oliver, Minister of Natural Resources for Canada, was our guest this week on the inaugural edition of the Energy Series of the World Show. I'm Bob Scully. Have a great week. Thanks.